This is WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, Greene, and Columbia counties in New York. Broadcasting locally on 90.7 FM and globally online at WGXC.org. This is the Art of the Hudson Valley, and I'm your host, Chad Weckler. And today we are going lit, literary, actually. And in today's studio here in Hudson, we've got Dave King. Dave is a writer, author, and he's the Arts Walk literary curator. Deborah Artman is also here. She's a fiction writer, librettist, editor, and dramaturg. And also Paul Lafarge, novelist, essayist, and a visiting writer at Bard College, who just made it to the studio from Bard, where he was teaching this afternoon. And before I get started, I was actually kind of curious, doing research on both Deborah and Paul. They both share NYFA fellowships, New York Foundation for the Arts, both for fiction. Deborah was in 02 and Paul was in 08. And it just so happens in July we had another NYFA fellowship in poetry, and that was Kara Benson. So it's kind of nice to see those things that sort of come across. And, of course, all of our guests today are local people and who are known internationally. I want to go back to the music you just heard, and that was from Lost Objects, which is a CD from 1997, a collaboration that Deborah did with Bang on a Can. And Deborah, I'm going to start with you since we had that music. And can you talk about your collaboration with Bang on a Can?
Yes. First of all, it's a very fun, ongoing collaboration with the three composers, Michael Gordon, David Lang, and Julia Wolf, who are the co-artistic directors of Bang on a Can. So I met them all originally at the Rightist and Artist Colony, the McDowell Colony in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and many years ago, like over 20 years ago. And after that meeting, began to work with them in different ways, and over the years became more involved in some of their music projects. And this was the first project we did, all four of us together. It was one of the, I think that the composers may have done at this point maybe four or five projects where they all work together. It's kind of rare for them. So this was a collaborative work.
You as a librettist.
With me as a librettist, which means that I provided them the text, and then they set it to music. And that was my first sort of large work, and I did a huge amount of research, and I gave them, I think, what Michael described as a telephone book's worth of music to write. And it was probably my best experience in terms of learning how to work with composers, what it is they like to receive. You know, all three composers are very different in how they like to work with text. So
and with the title being Lost Objects, you're not only talking about lost objects, but lost people, lost feelings. And so you...
It was a broad topic.
Yes.
The composers had certain ideas they wanted to explore that were based on the Talmud. So there's kind of a spine to the piece that relates to the Bible and some of the instructions regarding lost things. What happens if you find something, you know, like five plums scattered on a path versus what happens if you find five plums in a neat stack on a path? Like, there's all these rules. What happens if an animal like a donkey or an ox wanders onto your property? So in addition to that, we wanted to explore larger ideas of lost things, like lost memory and lost languages and lost species. and lost people, like explorers who've disappeared. And it was really fascinating for me to do the research because I felt like we walk around in our day-to-day society, but it's built on all these phantom lost things that we've discarded along the way, especially technologies. That was one of our categories that we explored. So I became aware of all these early forms of communication, for instance, and, you know, bizarre tools for signing signatures or, you know, just all kinds of early forms of communication that was used in the wars and, you know, coding systems. And it's...
Were any of the lost objects, did they anything have to do with airplanes?
Well, there we did, as a result of my research, you know, the composers picked ideas and people and language that appealed to them. And one composer chose to work with Amelia Earhart as an idea and some of the language around that. So, you know, she sort of represented a lost explorer. We did, there was one other in the piece as well, Mallory. We were interested in the people who sort of disappeared while trying to expand the map of, you know, people's understanding of the globe and stuff.
Well, that's going to make me segue into Paul, using that keyword airplanes. And Paul has a book that was just released. Wasn't the launch party day before yesterday in Manhattan?
Yeah.
And the title is Luminous Airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
That is a wild website, luminousairplanes.com. I just saw that today. And Paul, explain the novel and all the factions that are involved.
Sure. It's a novel. The novel is about a young computer programmer who's lived in San Francisco through the dot-com era. And when his grandfather dies, which happens at the beginning of the book, he's the person who ends up having to clean out the house where his grandparents have lived, which is in a town in the northern Catskills. It's a fictitious place kind of up back of where the real town of Maplecrest is. And he goes back to this house where he spent time as a child, and he's sorting through all of the clutter that his grandparents have left behind. And it's the occasion for him both to think back on his own life and also to renew relationships with people who he knew when he was young, who have also returned to this small and rather isolated place. And he ends up kind of taking stock of who he is as a person and trying to find a way to move on past his own past. That's the book. And then the website, which you mentioned, takes the stories that are told in the novel. It expands them in various directions. So there might be characters who are introduced in the book who have only a small part in the novel, and their stories are told at greater length on the website. It also continues the story of the novel past the point where the novel ends. And the idea of the website is that it's now about 10 years later. The book is set in the fall of 2000. The narrator returns to the story that he's told, and he's trying now to kind of, he's in a more isolated and in some ways a more desperate place, and he's trying to forge a connection with the rest of the world. And he begins to write kind of frantically all of these things which he feels that he's left out of the novel, and also to understand what's happened to him after this story that he told ended.
I love one of the quotes that's part of your own website. Paul Lafarge might be the greatest American writer you haven't read, but now there's no excuse.
Yeah, that's not my quote. It's not a quote from me, but it is
no,
a quote from a nice piece that that Time Out Chicago ran about the book.
And I, fortunately, we also have in the studio is Dave King, who will bring Paul back to Hudson on Sunday at the Hudson Opera House. And I'm going to go to Dave, who is the curator of Arts Walk, the literary portion of the CCCA, Clamath County Council on the Arts. And Dave is also a writer. And I think in his own way, as putting together this the Arts Walk for the last couple of years, the pairing that Dave does of usually two writers who work in tandem. Dave, I'm just going to segue right to you and talk about Arts Walk, which takes place starting tomorrow.
Okay. Chad, first I should tell your readership or your listenership that the literary program actually began with you, and that you did the first year of the programming, and I was one of the authors who was invited, and then you handed it off to me last year, and it's nice of you to give me all the credit, but we've sort of done it together a little bit. Yeah, so this year we have a program of 14 authors coming, most of them with new books, reading in Ghent, Chatham, and Hudson, beginning Friday night in Ghent at Art Omai with Francine Prose and Dana Spiata, and then ending, actually, Paul is on the last program at 6 p.m. at the Hudson Opera House, reading with Gary Steingart. And I think that will be a really good program. Paul actually was someone that I knew socially. We had a friend in common, and I asked him to read last year, and he read from his novel, Houseman or The Distinction, which is his novel about the the rebuilding of Paris by Baron Haussmann. And I was one of those people who, for whom that quote was written, in that Paul was the best novelist that I hadn't heard of until, or that I hadn't read until I read Haussmann. And it quickly became my favorite book that I read in 2010. And so I've been eagerly, eagerly awaiting Luminous Airplanes. And I'm delighted to have got my copy 2 days ago. And I'm looking forward to the reading on Sunday night.
Thanks, Dave.
Paul, how long did this process take to now have a book, Luminous Airplanes?
I started thinking about the project in the winter of 2000. So it's been going on for quite a while. And I knew from the beginning that I wanted to write a book that would have this this digital component, this kind of online presence, which would extend the story in different ways. But I didn't know exactly how to do it. And there was a lot of trial and error involved.
And isn't there a sort of trailer, a video trailer that you can see online? Could you explain that also?
Yeah, there's this kind of new thing that, you know, they decided that novelists had it too easy, so they would add another task to the menu of things that you have to do to publish a book. And now, not only do you have to write the book, and do you have to, you know, go around and do readings and whatever else is required, you have to, you know, blog. But you make a book trailer, which is a 1 or 2 minute video, which introduces the book, and generally they get posted on the web. Actually, Gary Steingart is kind of who I'll be reading with on Sunday at the Arts Walk Hudson. Was kind of the person who's to blame for this. He made a very, very funny trailer starring him and James Franco, who was then in the Columbia MFA program, and some other Columbia students, and a number of other people, Jay McInerney, Mary Gateskill, and a bunch of marketing interns. And the premise of it is that Gary has written this book, but that he actually can't read. And so he just goes around and everyone talks about how much they love the book, and he says, "I can't read." And thousands and thousands of people watch this thing. So now everyone says, "Oh, we have to make book trailers." So I made one, and I It's really just an introduction to the project, and in particular to the website, which is the part that seems like it needs the most introduction because it's something that hasn't been done before.
And Deborah, I also saw you in a video clip, which is available on the internet, and that has to do with a new work that you have done, Aquanetta. Could you explain Aquanetta a little bit and how people can, I forget how I actually went to see that video, but explain both processes if you could.
Sure. I had a question for Paul as he was talking.
Oh, go ahead and you can ask.
Which was whether the work that you posted online, did that mirror your own process of writing the book? You know, it sounds like, you know, there was the initial idea for the book, and then you're approaching it this many years later, and so I wondered if it somehow mirrored your own process.
Yes and no. It's a wonderful question. Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the fact that the narrator has taken this many years to, you know, within his fictive world to write this whole project reflects the fact that I too have taken this many years to get Luminous Airplanes even to this point, because the website isn't finished. There's more writing to do. And the narrator's frustration at the amount of time it's taken is certainly expressive of my own frustration during the darker moments in the whole process. But unlike the narrator, I knew from the beginning that this was the form I wanted the
right.
project to take. So, you know, I didn't have this kind of double take where I had finished the book and then I thought, oh, wait, and I should also continue writing these stories. I knew that I wanted to write them. I just had no idea how the parts of it could fit together in such a way that the book would be interesting to read as a book and the website would be interesting to look at as a website, and the two would somehow lead to each other.
Well, Paul, what is immersive text?
Immersive text is what the name that we've given to this project, which is sort of what's beyond the book. And I think one reason that we chose the word immersive is because it is literally a kind of an immersive experience. It's a very large website. There's probably three times as much text in the website as there is in the book.
Wow.
And it branches in all different directions. So you really can lose yourself in it if that's something that you're interested in doing. There's also a kind of practical historical reason for the word immersive, as opposed to the older name for this kind of writing, which was hypertext. And that's that hypertext fiction was a very big deal circa 1993. And there were a number of hypertext novels published in the 90s, but the genre didn't continue. There was a wave which ended right around the year 2000. And we decided that we would choose a new name to sort of indicate that this is not a continuation of that project, although it does look back to the idea of hypertext, which was very current about 15 years ago.
And Aquanetta has some similarities a little bit.
Well, the video that you were talking about was one that was made last year by people connected with the New York City Opera, because Michael Gordon, who was the composer on that project, and I had excerpts of the opera performed as part of their Vox Festival, and it was really a fun experience to hear it again. It was originally... The premiere was in Germany, in Aachen, and now we're looking for a full production here in the U.S., and we sort of also have envisioned the second act that we'd like to make for it. So the premise of Aquanetta is that she is actually a real person. She was a B-movie star in the 1940s and became... originally a pinup model in New York City, and then was so astonishingly beautiful that she was the kind of person who was actually stopped on the street by someone who said, "I'm going to make you a star." And, you know, Walter Winchell sort of supported her, and she ended up out in Hollywood. And the interesting thing about her is that she told everybody that she was Native American. And I think it was Walter Winchell decided that that wasn't cool enough at the time. And so they decided that she would be called the Venezuelan Volcano. And she spoke with this odd Latin accent. And in fact, she was neither of these, which is what we discovered in the course of our research. And that's kind of what the opera is about. And the opera kind of deconstructs this one scene in the film that she's most famous for, which is this B-movie, where she plays this character that transforms from a gorilla into a woman. And then whenever she's angry or especially passionate, she has the misfortune to change back from a woman into a gorilla. And so the scene that we deconstruct in the film is the operating room scene with the mad scientist, and the brainy woman is one of our characters. She donates her brain to science. And
John Carradine is the actor who plays the mad scientist.
Who played the original mad scientist. And then we also have the director, who is Edward Dimitrik, who has his own interesting past in that he was one of the original Hollywood 10. And then he turned around and did give names. And so everybody, I mean, we sort of explored the people behind the characters, you know, the actors and the director and such playing these different roles. So it's a lot about role playing, you know, who we are versus who we present, and the kinds of masks we wear. And it's a really fun project. The music's fantastic because it kind of refers to horror music, and you know, there's a lot of shrieking, kind of controlled shrieking, but it's really fun. Like, it's very kind of rock and roll.
So the composer is working with not only the film visual, but also the research and the words that you've brought to the table.
Yeah, well, in the video, they use clips from the film, and I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of a really fun project for a director to take on, because I kind of had this vision of the first part being set in that black and white palette, you know, of the film period, and the actual movie itself, sort of based on that look of that. But it's not necessary for the film to be part of the production. That's something that Vox did to sort of give it a context, and so that their listeners and the viewers of the concert would understand who the five characters were who were singing. Because in the pieces that we did for Vox, they were both quintuplets, and they involved all the characters. The ape is one of the characters, the person who wears the gorilla suit. She's a soprano. She's the highest soprano. There's Aquanetta. There's the mad scientist, doctor person, the brainy woman, and I'm forgetting someone.
Well, I want to also sort of the composer, Dave. I think you're sort of the composer of Arts Walk, and back to how you. You look at you like the local writers, you like people who are currently working, but for instance, to bring Paul and Gary together, and Gary, I'm looking forward to, he was profiled in this month's Chronogram. Just the one page is a wonderful read, and he is funny. I mean, how do you, when you're thinking about, and you do this fairly early before Arts Walk really begins, how do you do the process of curating writers?
Well, I had some feelers out to people last year who weren't able to participate, and so some of them were able to participate this year. I keep track of which one of the ones of the people I know and what local writers have new books. You know, the literary program that I'm sort of working from has a number of agendas, and one of them is to increase readership and literacy in our neighborhoods. Another is to support independent booksellers, and so if people have a new book, then that's good for both the author and the independent booksellers. And one of the things that I've tried to do with my 2 years of curating Arts Walk is find an interesting unpublished manuscript and give that writer an opportunity to present a work in progress and drum up some enthusiasm for the book before it's published, but also to talk about process a little bit. And so last year we had Richard Bach, as you remember, reading from his manuscript about working at the Mud Club. And Richard was great. He showed up with this huge entourage of people from, you know, Andy Warhol's factory. And this year, Hudson resident Suzanne Snyder will be appearing on Saturday evening with Melissa Holbrook Pearson. And Suzanne's book is the work in progress, and it's about rival communes. It's a work that has generated a lot of excitement, and I think Suzanne hopes it'll come out in the next year. And it's called The Revival. And then Melissa will be reading from a book called The Man Who Will Stop at Nothing, which is about long-distance motorcycle riding. And so I think the two of them will make a very interesting pairing. So that's sort of, I mean, a lot of it is somewhat intuitive, but it's, you know, it's the information I know about the literary scene, who's around, who has books coming out, what kinds of personalities fit well together. We had one reader from a previous year who came to me this year and said, I have a new book. Can I do it again? And I said, yeah, sure. Why not? You know, so it's sort of like that.
And last year you had, was it Susan Orlean, who had not completed her book about Rin Tin Tin, and now it's out?
Yeah, yeah. She read actually the portion of the Rin Tin Tin book that was in, that appeared in The New Yorker this past summer. And it was great. I mean, it's a really lovely piece, and Susan is, you know, charming and sexy and delightful, and she was really great last year.
Have there been any, personally, I am finding more and more, especially when we do things on the radio or we have more bookstores and more, the Hudson Valley is very rich with writers, and you're discovering this, that there are writers popping up all the time, and you do a newsletter, which I think is wonderful.
Yeah, I one of the things that you and I learned last year was that people came to the reading series almost by chance. There was no organized way to get the word out. And so in the wake of that, I started this e-newsletter called Hudson River Literary. And I send it out like every 2 weeks. And it includes lists of new books, readings in the area, grant opportunities, reading groups, writing workshops, fellowship opportunities, blogs, anything that has to do with the literary community. And if listeners want to subscribe, it's free, and I mean it's just an email really. But send me an email at hudsonriverliterary@gmail.com.
Cool. And we'll probably should also say the Arts Walk is this year produced by the Columbia County Council on the Arts, and to go to their website to see the literary programs and everything that's starting tomorrow, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. That's www.artscolumbia.org. And then you can see the whole schedule. Let's go back to Deborah for a moment. Explain a little bit of what a dramaturg does. What is a dramaturg?
A dramaturg does for a play what an editor does for a book. So it's someone who I often work with performers and playwrights who are first generating all the material for a play or a production, and they'll come to me and they'll say, here I have all this stuff, I'm not quite sure how to shape it. Or they'll already have it shaped in some way, but they know it's not working quite right. Hmm. So I look at that kind of text and I'll make recommendations about what they might cut, where they might expand, that sort of thing.
Can you give an example of something recent that...
Yeah, I've been working most recently with this incredibly talented performing artist named Deborah Carpel on a piece called Songs My Mother Never Taught Me. Hmm. And she's going to be doing a performance of it in November. Actually, it's November 1st down in the city at Dixon Place. And the way I think of Deborah is if Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca had a love child, it would be, she would be Deborah Carpel. The piece is really a fun piece that mixes music and actually sung songs, like some quite complicated oratory, you know, opera type work, but also a lot of Yiddish music. And it's, the piece is based on Deborah's experiences with fronting a klezmer Yiddish band. So she had to learn Yiddish to work with these people, and suddenly she was like, well, how did I arrive here? Hmm. And then she explores, it's a family story as well, where she gets into her background and discovers this closet in her father's apartment that's filled with all this early Yiddish music, and suddenly there's this pocket to her family history that she wasn't aware of. So it's a really well done piece, and it's very tight now from my dramaturg
good for
input.
It sounds like you'd like to wear a lot of different hats.
I do. I like working with people and helping them with text, you know. So I like that aspect of collaborative work. And I originally started as a poet, and then I became a fiction writer, and then I felt lonely. So I started doing theater and in the city in the 80s, and it was a really fertile time then for great work, and I found Laurie Carlos and Jessica Hagedorn and Robbie McCauley and all these incredible actress, writer, director, performers, you know, people who were doing everything. And maybe because of that, it just became kind of normal to want to try to do everything.
I just want to remind our listeners, we have three guests in the studio. You were just listening to Deborah Artman, and we have Dave King and Paul Lafarge. And I'm going to ask Paul to read something, a selection from Luminous Airplanes. Is there something that you would like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it would make maybe the most sense just to read the beginning, because then I don't have to explain anything.
That's good.
Although I have this dream. One day I want to write a short story which will be only like the kind of thing that people say at the introduction of fiction readings, where they're trying to explain who everyone is. And it'll go on for like 10 minutes. I'll just get on the stage. I'll be like, okay, so you need to know that John is Fred's brother, and they've been, you know, snowbound in a cabin in Wyoming since 1946, you know, and I'll just go on like that for 10 minutes, then I'll get off the stage.
Good.
But I'm not going to do that. No, I'm just going to read from the beginning of the book. So here. I had just come home from a festival in Nevada, the theme of which was contact with other worlds, when my mother, or I should say, one of my mothers, called to tell me that my grandfather had died. I've been trying to reach you for days, she said. Where were you? I told her I'd been camping. I didn't tell her I was at a pagan celebration where people danced around bonfires, a kind of dress rehearsal for the end of the world. I didn't mention the huge glowing fish or the women with wings. Celeste told me that my grandfather had died on Thursday morning, around the time when I was leaving San Francisco in my friend's big white RV. My Uncle Charles found him collapsed at his desk.
He'd had a heart attack, the doctor said. His death was quick and probably not painful. That's good, I said, still dazed from the drugs I'd taken at the festival and the nights I'd gone without sleep. When is the funeral? It was this morning. You had it without me? We couldn't wait, Celeste said, in the tone of voice she uses when eliding facts that might put her in the wrong. Marie is closing an issue and she has to go back to work. Marie is Celeste's twin sister, by birth Marie Celeste, as Celeste was by birth Celeste Marie. Another story. She works for S, a women's magazine. But, I began to protest, but Celeste wasn't finished catching me up on what I'd missed. We're going to sell the house, she said. Do you want any of your grandparents' things? It would mean going back to upstate New York, she said, because the house was full from attic to basement with junk, and my mother's had no intention of sorting through it. They never got along with my grandfather, and my grandmother, with whom, to be honest, they also didn't get along, had given them the few items they wanted before she died. Celeste said that unless I wanted to clean out the house myself, they would be happy to turn it over to one of the people who specialized in estate sales. Probably the antiques dealers would take a few pieces my grandfather had inherited from his parents, and the rest would be thrown away or given to orphans. Which orphans? I asked. Whichever ones they have up there, Celeste said. Then, as if she realized that she'd overplayed her frustration at not having been able to reach me, she asked, Since when do you like camping? I always liked camping. You did? Since I was a kid. Celeste hesitated. Think it over, she said. But don't take too long. The real estate agent says our best chance of selling is before the ski season starts. Our conversation ended awkwardly, and I stood in my kitchen, not sure what to do next. 8 hours ago, I'd been sitting in the middle of a desert, eating instant oatmeal from a plastic cup, and watching the remains of a giant wooden structure called the exosphere smolder. Now my grandfather was dead, and Celeste wanted me to return to Thebes, where I hadn't been for 10 years. It was as if my life had cut abruptly from one record to another, and my thoughts were still dancing to the wrong beat. That was the image that occurred to me after three days of watching DJs perform at the festival. I tried to feel grief at my grandfather's death. I tried to imagine him dying, to see him being buried, but all I could see was Nevada, the long line of the horizon, with sharp brown mountains rising up in the distance. A silver pinwheel turned slowly in the wind. I wondered if I was all right, if there was something wrong with me. It's a question I've been asking myself a lot recently, and the answer I keep coming up with is, yes, something is wrong.
Cool. And how does the immersive text, since we have now a flavor of the novel, where does it go from there?
It goes down. So I gave a reading a few years ago at Wesleyan from this book, and I was still in the process of figuring the book out, and I was describing this character, and I realized, you know, suddenly we talk about narrative arc, right, and the character's journey through a book. This character's trajectory is like, it's just like a falling rock. he starts off in an okay place, and then it just goes, woo, thud, you know. And that, so the immersive text finds him farther along on that trajectory. And then the question that's going to sustain him through it is, how can he come back from this kind of plummet?
Must you read the book first? Must you go to the website first? Can you do both?
You can do either one. The hope is that the book will stand on its own. You can pick it up. You can read it. Or you could just look at the website and read that. But if I did my job right, what'll happen is you'll read the book and then you'll be curious to know what happened next. Mm. So you'll go to the website, or you'll look at the website for a while and you'll be curious to pick up the book.
I'm curious for all three of you who write, is it difficult to balance more than one piece that you're working on, or are some of you capable of doing two or three things at once? I mean, Paul, you teach, and Deborah is working on many facets, and Dave has a book that's already out, and he's got a book that's coming out. Dave, why don't you start and Is it easy to do more than one written piece at a time?
I think most people find it difficult. I certainly find it really hard to switch gears. You know, between teaching and writing, or even writing and reading, you know, writing and editing, I always think that there's something wrong with me because I have a hard time moving from one action to the next. I don't multitask well, and I think that's true of a lot of writers, and a lot of the writers that I admire the most have to really lose themselves in their work. Mm-hmm. And once you've lost yourself in your work, it's very hard to then snap out of it and lose yourself in something else. You know, you can't just go around all day losing yourself. You know, it's
like some of this.
Yeah. Be like Paul's character.
Yeah, or like your opera. You know, you just become your very own lost object.
Right, that's right.
Deborah,
I think it's difficult. I personally am a one thing at a time person. Even though I do many things, I'll do one fully. Mm. You know, and become immersed in it. So that's the word for the day.
Yeah.
And then I'll usually need a decompression period afterwards. If I'm working with somebody else, I often have, you know, delayed reactions that I'll want to communicate with them. Oh, yeah, you know, I'll have a dream that fixes some problem or something like that.
And Paul also teaches, as Dave does.
As does Dave, yeah.
So you go from teaching, and then do you immediately go home and work on the text for the website?
For the last 6 or 8 months, I've been working in a state of total desperation. And I have to say that that's the only solution I found to the problem of teaching and writing at the same time is that terror is a very strong motivator. And I knew that the website was going to happen on a particular date, you know, Tuesday, a couple days ago. Mm. And that it had to be ready by then. And so since January, I've been panicking. So yes, I can teach, and then I come home, and panic impels me to keep writing. And because I'm writing from the head of a narrator who is himself kind of distraught, the fit feels good. But otherwise, I have to say that I completely agree with Dave. It's a very hard transition to make. And it's, I think, under, you know, if I got sort of my choice, I would do those things, but I wouldn't do them at the same time.
It's sort of a strange question. Myself not being a writer, is it easy to write and then read someone? Say you write your own work in the morning. Can you read someone else's work at night? I know it's kind of a peculiar question.
I find I'm... Do you mean like a novel, like before you go to bed or mm-hmm. something like that?
Yeah.
I find that difficult because I internalize the rhythms that people write with. So say it's an author that writes with a really long line, then I might feel impelled to write fiction with a really long line. And so my access to my own voice, I think, is probably so tenuous that it's difficult for me to read another's. So I think when I'm deeply writing fiction,
immersed,
it would, for me, I think it's a little difficult, but it's also can be inspiring to read somebody great while you're working on your own stuff, and you read something that's really great and you feel like, yeah, I want to contribute to the world of letters. You know, this person's doing good stuff. And so,
you know, I feel that way too, particularly about the being very easily influenced. When I'm at my most creative, I can't read Updike, or I start trying to create those kinds of very, very fancy similes and metaphors that he does. And that type of writing doesn't come naturally, and so I do it badly. And so I dare not be influenced by him lest I start doing bad Updike. But the other thing is that I feel like I need to be reading really good stuff. And when I'm teaching, I'm often only reading my students' work, which is, you know, not as inspiring as reading, you know, Nabokov or David Mitchell or Murakami or anyone that you truly admire, you know. And that's always a problem for me. If I spend a lot of time reading student work, then I get a an exalted notion of how good my own work is, and it's only good in comparison to, like, undergraduates.
I mean, I completely agree with Deborah that I need to keep reading fiction just to remember how wonderful it can be when someone else is finished with it, as opposed to how awful it is when I'm in the middle of writing it. But I think maybe I'm a little less wise about letting my compass needle swing sort of towards the people I'm reading. And I'm happy to kind of follow what I've been reading, at least for when I'm writing a first draft of something. And then what'll happen is I'll find that, you know, I've written 30 pages in the style of W.G. Sebald, and everyone who looks at it will know. And then I kind of go back and take that out and try to find where it was that I was going before I picked up that book.
What are all those photographs doing in this text?
Well, so in the immersive text, I mean, there are actually tons of photographs. But then I tried a different strategy, which is that I'm clearly stealing something from this German writer named W.G. Sebald, who put photographs in his short stories and novels. And they're beautiful. They're very melancholic. They're very sober. And they're very interesting. And I thought, I love this. I'm just going to do it. But since the immersive text has this ability to comment endlessly on itself, I did it, and then I wrote a long note explaining that I knew that I was stealing and sort of challenging the reader to call me out for stealing when it seems as though everyone is also stealing all the time.
Yeah.
It's like John Berger.
Deborah, are you working on a novel? Do you have something soon to be published?
Two different questions. I am working on a novel. It was soon to be published, but I never made my due date. Mm. So now it's late. So I'm needing to finish it. Mm. but I would say that the last few years have been filled with a lot of transitions for me, and I only moved to Catskill a year ago, and just recently I was at my desk and I was feeling like, okay, I'm at my desk. You know, I felt like my desk was a safety zone, and so I'm feeling positive about getting back to work on the novel.
I mean, deadlines certainly are a part of any professional's life, and all three of you have gone through that process, and I remember last year Dave was working on a new novel, and talk about, didn't you go to Rome to sort of put out, you know, remove yourself a little bit and get back to getting the novel done?
Yeah, I mean, I had to enter into a passage where I was just alone, and my original plan was to rent a cabin in some remote spot, and then I got an email from an acquaintance in Rome who wanted to rent his apartment, and it was really cheap, and it was Rome, and it came with the internet and utilities and a bicycle. So that was my cabin in the Poconos that I went to instead. But I did sit by myself in my room. I didn't do any touring. I, you know, just kind of worked by myself, and it was an opportunity to have a retreat. But yeah, that was because, like Deborah, I missed a deadline also. So, you know, we gotta get going.
Paul, what is it like to actually have a deadline? I mean,
to have a deadline that you would embarrass yourself enormously by missing?
That sounds like that does happen.
Mm. My wife is a theater director and producer, and she works at the Vineyard Theater in New York City, which is an off-Broadway theater. And she's always up late, sort of sending emails desperately to try to make something happen. And I'm always a little grumpy about it, because, you know, I want to go to bed, and I'm like, honey, put the laptop away. You know, let's get our books and we'll just read. But recently, I had to produce this book party, which was also on deadline and also a kind of elaborate production. And before that, I was working on the website. And all of a sudden, I understood what total panic is, because there's a date when, you know, the world is going to start looking at this thing to the extent that the world cares about it at all. And if it's not ready, no one's going to come back and look at it again. Mm.
So then I was the person in bed with the laptop sending emails desperately.
Sure, absolutely.
That's what I like about theater is, you know, you have the curtains gonna go up and you have to have the work done by then. And I think I was just talking to an author who I'm going to be working with on a manuscript that she's developing. And I said to her, you know, I think with fiction, you just never feel done. I mean, even when it's published and there's a formal cover on it, I read something where someone probably well-known and who I can't remember at this moment said, you know, you're a better writer at the end of the book than you are at the beginning of a book. And
Graham Greene.
Oh, is that who it was? Thank you. and I think that's true. So you could always keep going back and, you know, editing. You can always, you know, fall into this state of editing limbo and not give it up. And I think theater is great because you have to give it up.
Mm. Well, we have just a few minutes left. And Deborah, since you have the mic at the moment, is you want to mention some of the things that you're working on, things coming up that you can share with our listening audience?
Well, I mentioned Deborah's piece. That's November 1st at Dixon Place in the city. I think it's going to be really good. And next year, you can save the date. Lost Objects, which originally was performed at the Brooklyn Academy of Music back in 2004, it's going to have another production at Alice Tully Hall I'll give you the date. April 27th at Alice Tully Hall in New York City, Lost Objects. It probably won't be the full production with the theater element that originally was done by Francois Girard, who's also a film director. But it will have the full Baroque orchestra and the electric instruments and the full choir and the three voices, which are two sopranos, two countertenors and one soprano. It's a very beautiful piece. I recommend it.
Paul, what is up for you?
Well, I'm going to go see Deborah's piece. Oh. I'm excited about that. Before that, I'm reading, as Dave said, on October 9th, on Sunday, at 6 p.m. with Gary Steingart at the Hudson Opera House as part of the Arts Walk. And then I'm also going to read on Saturday, October 22nd, at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck at 7:30.
Wonderful. And Dave, want to give Arts Walk a plug? And
yeah, let me just quickly, I know we're running out of time, but here's the schedule. Tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Art Omai, we have Francine Prose and Dana Spiata. Saturday in Chatham at the Painter Group Pub, at various times in the afternoon into the evening, Stephen O'Connor and Helen Benedict. Then Mark Wunderlich and Sarah Faulkner. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, Melissa Holbrook Pearson with Suzanne Snyder. And then on Sunday, we move to the Hudson Opera House. Mary Johnson and Dara Lurie started out at 2:30, followed by L.S. Azakoff and Carol Mazzo, and then, of course, Paul Lafarge and Gary Steingart. I hope to see everyone there.
Dave, plug your book that's going to come out. Another minute or two.
It doesn't have a publisher yet. I don't know when it'll come out, but it's called The Beast and Beauty, and the author is Dave King.
Can I plug Dave's book? Sure. I heard Dave read from it at a reading in Hudson almost a year ago, wasn't it?
I think so,
It was at a fundraiser for this station, if I'm not totally crazy.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, I still remember the passage that you read. I thought it was great.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
the WGXC fundraiser that we did was during the barn raising, and it was called WGXC Word. And Paul also performed a piece. Well, it was performed with you. It was The Sound of Sizzling Bacon.
Yes, I wrote it. I used to write a column about bacon for a magazine called Meat Paper. A journal of meat culture.
Well, I think that will be it for the Art of the Hudson Valley. I want to thank our guest, Deborah Artman, Paul Lafarge, and Dave King. And it's been a wonderful hour. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Chad.
Thank you, Chad.
Thanks, Chad.
And we'll see everybody on the radio in a month for the Art of the Hudson Valley.
This is Miles from Hudson.